Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 134 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer. My dear co-host Sari Kamen is living it up in Southern California right now, but I am not alone in studio. Today, I am joined by the force behind Rouge Tomat's unprecedented beverage program, Pascaline Lepeltier, Master Sommelier. Welcome to The Morning After, Pascaline.
Bonjour.
Also in studio, another French force in the wine industry, Camille Riviere. She is of Camille Riviere Selections. Welcome to The Morning After, Camille. This is your second time on the show.
Salut, Jessie. Thank you.
So she's here to be my translator, just in case Pascaline needs it.
Merci.
totally kidding. Their English is much better than my French. That's not saying a lot, though. I'm sorry. I'm really serious.
I think it's a very smart move to have Kemi next to me.
Perfect. Good. Yes. Last minute decisions. I love them. So Rouge Tomat closed its uptown doors last year, and they're going to be reopening in June. So we'll talk to Pascaline about that. We'll also just talk to her about wine, and more wine. Later in the show, we'll give Pascaline the MS exam of The Morning After, but with 100% less pressure, The Morning After quiz. But first, I've been gone for like 3 weeks, so there's been so much happening in food news. This is something that hits home with you ladies, I imagine. On Christmas Day, a thief stole some of the world's best wine, I'm using quotations, some of the world's best wine from the French Laundry. I think it was upwards of $300,000 worth of wine, some DRC, some Screaming Eagle. Thoughts? Any feelings? I personally feel bad for them. That sucks to feel violated like that.
Oh, it's feel absolutely terrible. You know what do you want to say? It's like you spend time to build something, and the day you close and like you get this break to redo all yourself, you just like boom, been robbed. So no, I felt terrible for them. It's always like whatever they took is always is stealing, you know. So
you feel like this was like an inside job, because they took basically the most expensive and some of the most exclusive wine on the list, right?
You know, I'm judging from the East Coast in New York, but like obviously there is a purpose behind that. You know, it's you're not going to be able to resell some Stella Artois or some Modelo beer. You know, it's not the same thing for DRC. But there is a lot of, you know, I think they don't realize that this wine are kind of so looked after right now that where they're going to pop up, we will know.
Do you think they can they track that? Because the wines are so exclusive. Will they be able to know by like bottle number or
every bottle?
Like that?
Every bottle, basically, when you export, you have each bottle is numbered, and you know which numbers you gave to which importer, which helps you on the gray market. Also, for example, if you sell to Canada, bottle number 1, 2, and 3, and then you end up in New York seeing them on the market, you know it went gray market, meaning that someone in the United States illegally bought it from Canada. So it allows the producer to squeeze on allocation the year after Canada, because they've been selling it to another market in the United States, which doesn't allow the producer to own its distribution, because some people are going behind and doing a lot of
backside, yeah.
So do you think they'll be caught?
Well, if the French Laundry took the numbers down, which I highly doubt, of all of their allocated bottles, maybe some of the sums took pictures, and you can retrieve the numbers.
When you get your allocation, you like the distributor, they should know which bottle got where to with the number of the DRC, so they should be able to track down the number.
But well, good. That's some good news. Thank you. I had no idea what they were going to do. I was just thinking these thieves would start chugging it. And
but for example, I don't know about this. I used to work for a distributor who sold a Rousseau, which is also a highly allocated Burgundy. But I'm not quite sure. If I'm working for that distributor, we didn't know which item numbers went and to who they went.
Yeah, but on DRC, you have bottle numbers on every single bottle, you know, on the label itself. Mm-hmm. And when you get them, you can't resell them. It's like part of the thing. So you should be able to track down a little bit. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's just a pain for them. Like I feel very bad because it's.
It's not gonna come back.
No. And even if it comes back, you don't even know how it has been like taken care of or mm-hmm. anything. So no, I felt bad for them just for that.
Well, on another note, ladies, are you familiar with the fast food chain White Castle?
From very far.
So not too familiar.
Mm-hmm. From driving on the highway and deciding not to stop.
Exactly. Yeah. Perfect. Perfect. Well, White Castle is entering the 20th century, meaning they're stuck in the 90s. They're unveiling a veggie burger at the White Castle. This to me is like Michael Jordan playing baseball. Kind of like stick to what you know. You know, they know small little burgers. I mean, are people going to buy a veggie burger on the side of the road? Well, listen, does this make it more enticing? The mini patties, according to the chain, are chock full of vegetables like carrot, zucchini, peas, spinach, broccoli, and more. Do you think they're going to make it burger colored?
Beep, beep. Beep, beep.
No, but it's a good, like, I don't know, it's pretty, like, meaning that when you see these big brands, like, starting to realize that there is trends happening that were absolutely against their business model, you're like, okay, it makes sense. You know, you realize that the food revolution is stronger than you can think, maybe. You're like, it's the opposite of what they were doing. They're doing something else that is really towards another goal. Maybe tomorrow they're going to start to do organic burger. You know, you're like, wow. So for me, it means that there is some change and they are observing, even though if probably for revenue and to make more money and all that stuff, at least they are taking notice about change. And it's always good to see people just aware a little bit about that. After that, I won't stop. because like non-organic, probably overproduced,
frozen
vegetables is not what I'm looking for. But, you know, it's the beginning of something. It's a bit of that not moving and just...
Yeah, McDonald's in France started doing salads about 10 years ago.
Yeah, in France, McDonald's is sourcing in France. And like there is a pretty strict way of sourcing. Even though it remains McDonald's, they just really try to do something a little bit more advanced in terms of product and the offer. It's very different from the offer from the U.S. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say I haven't eaten McDonald's in probably like 7 years, so... But it's here, I know. My brother eats at McDonald's once a week.
He counts down the day he gets to eat McDonald's. No, I mean, I agree with you. It hopefully will lead to better food practices by fast food chains, but I'm not going to hold my breath. So next on the news feed, there's a look back at some of the weirdest food mashups. Of 2014. You guys are familiar with this. I think the most famous, which was a few years ago, is like the Dorito taco shell kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Right? We familiar with this? Mm. So here's what really stood out to me. And I'm expecting this to be on Rouge Tomat's beer list tomorrow. Sriracha plus beer. Rogue Sriracha hot stout beer.
You know what? I'm sure it works. Oh.
Yeah, really? Really? I mean, I understand like putting a little like spice in your margarita or something like that, a little like pepper in your beer, but sriracha?
Okay, sriracha. So most of the of my team used to put sriracha in everything. So I wouldn't be surprised to see sriracha in Guinness soon as being the new cocktail trend on the Lower East Side. I'm not sure, but I just can't take sriracha. It's just too spicy for me. I would just collapse on the ground right now with sriracha. So I have even no idea what sriracha tastes because it's really super painful. I tried once and it was just too spicy, but I'm not surprised. I take it.
Would you try it, or you would just be too afraid just because it said sriracha?
I would say 1/20th of sriracha and the rest in Guinness. I would probably be able to do it. Yeah.
I mean, I would hope that it's at least a palatable beer. that you're not just like you know, choking on the sriracha. But you never know. Kemi, would you drink it?
Way, of course. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Spicy. Well, you're into beer, too.
No, I'm more into spice than beer.
Oh, okay. Well, good. The perfect is the perfect beer for you. I'm sorry, I don't have any in studio for us to try, yeah. But maybe we'll try to get that later. So additionally, with the weird things to add to beer, frozen pizza plus beer in Norway. You can definitely guess that one of the evil twin guys is behind it. It says, what happens when two brewmasters get together to have some fun in Norway? They make beer with Norway's favorite frozen pizza.
How?
I think they maybe throw the pizza into the mash and let it ferment or something. What do you think? What kind of a flavor profile would that add to the beer?
I never try to ferment ham.
Chippa, maybe if you serve it, you know, with a big beanie and a very large beard, that could be really delicious.
And some flannel. They say that the mouthfeel is like Norwegian oil.
Kidding. It makes sense. There's a lot of cheese, you know. You have the thing with the protein, so... My God, where do you find that stuff?
It's on the internet, Pascaline. You can find anything on the internet. I mean, I may be one of the few people who has a very hard time finding one evil twin beer I can have more than two sips of, because there is certainly a richness to it. It's a much, you know, they're very exciting beers. Lots going on. But Norwegian oil? That's like, can you even swallow that?
No, but can we find it here? Is it?
That I don't know yet. I don't know yet. Let's look it on the market.
I am. I think Brooklyn Brewery is going to Norway anyway to start brewing something.
Yeah,
so we should, to invade Europe. So maybe we should ask those guys
to bring the frozen beer pizza. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we might be able to find it at Tours. You never know.
Oh, God. Ugh. At least, you know, it's a dream of drinking and eating at the same time. You know, you just finally made it. So, and then we should do something in France, Camille, like with cassoulet. No, we should kind of...
Cassoulet beer.
Cassoulet beer.
Super digest cassoulet beer. Number one.
Yuck. We're going to take a break here on the morning after. We're going to think about our other beer creations that we could make. We're going to come back with Pascaline Lepeltier, Master Sommelier at Rouge Tomont.
White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here on The Morning After, from philosopher to natural wine goddess, Pascaline Lepeltier, Master Sommelier and Beverage Director of Rouge Tomont in New York City, is one of the most exciting people to follow in the world of wine, period. Welcome to The Morning After, Pascaline.
Oh, it's a lot.
I hope you live up to it in the interview.
Yeah, me too now. I'm like, start to shake.
No. Now, so you were born in Brittany and raised in the Loire Valley, am I correct? See other things you can find out on the internet.
Yeah, I know it's not correct, but
so did
internet's
you,
lies.
You so tell me about the Loire Valley then.
Yeah, I grew up in the Loire.
You grew up in the Loire. Yeah. Okay, so it wasn't a lie. Aha. So in the Loire Valley, surrounded by vineyards, but that's not what made you decide to go into wine, right?
No, it was wine.
It was wine itself. It wasn't the Loire Valley.
No, it's like when, but it's always easier when you live in an environment around you, surrounding by vineyards, you know, right away. But until probably my 18th anniversary, I was drinking way more bad booze and bad beers than anything else, you know. And
just like any other 18-year-old.
Probably, yeah. And bad wines. We have something sweet in a region called Coteau du Layon, and so I was drinking that, and it was like bad, overly sulfur, disgusting. So stuff you get headaches with. So I just didn't drink wine until somebody showed me the way. It happens to be my philosophy teacher. So you're in love with your philosophy teacher. He brings you to wine. You're like, oh, if he drinks wine, it must be good, studying to wine. And so, and then he showed me, he just made me understand it was way more than just getting drunk and having headaches the day after. And that's it. And then he, little by little, he made his way.
So do people just, and this has happened, I have one of my servers is from France, and I want to know, do people just often assume that you know a lot about wine just because you're French?
It's in our DNA, of course.
Yeah, we have it. Like, cut my hands, going to be blowing Cabernet Franc.
Like, instead of breast milk, you're, yeah, drinking Cabernet Franc.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you respond to things like that? Especially as a master sommelier, like, you've gone through it, you know.
But what do you want me to say? No, like, no, yes, France... I wish current generation of French probably will know more about food and wine than they do, just because it's like everywhere else, you know, parents don't cook anymore unless you're in certain areas. The only good thing is we have access to a lot of fresh product, you know. I think as a country we are very lucky because we are producing a bunch of very high end fruit, vegetables, wines, a lot of local things. But if you see what I was just mentioning, my brother, when you see what my brother is eating and drinking, you're like, okay, that is like, it's like any teenagers in a wealthy country. You know, he's going to fast food, he's drinking beers, he's going booze, and there we are just little by little missing that acknowledgement of the patrimony. And also, don't forget, in France, you can't promote wine. You know, there is no that it's huge, but you don't have that kind of overly respectful way of thinking wine as something cultural. Is starting, like, we are trying to put Champagne or Saint-Emilion as part of the UNESCO history, but otherwise you can't promote wine. There is law forbidding it. It's like, so yeah, no, not like when people say, oh, you French, you must know wine, I say, you know what, I learn wine. And it doesn't, yeah. But when I have French guests at the restaurant coming, everything's in a wine, and it's pretty funny. It's very funny. I'm sure you know that, me too. It's
like, they usually go for the appellation. Oh oui, bien sûr, j'adore Saint-Julien.
Oh, it's always Saint-Julien.
It's always Saint-Julien, you know. I'm like, oh, okay, which one of the 2,000 producers do you like out there?
La Grange.
Yeah.
The vintage, the 2005.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can understand that. So in France, you know, as far as wine goes, people in certain areas, they don't want to uplift the wine. It's just like a part of the everyday, or...
It's just... First, I think, like, first, French people are drinking less and less wine. There is a switch in the consumption of what they are drinking. There is definitely a movement happening with... What I like, and when Camille's like to and support like all the natural wine movement and the conscious that you need to pay attention to the way you farm, and at every level, what if it's wine or anything else, with people really dig into their place and really believing that there is an expression to have. But it's still a minority. You know, it's not like a lot of people are making their grocery shopping in a supermarket and it's brands. You know, it's the easiest way right now to do so. So it's a very strange time, I think. The country, it's not the majority. What you think France is not the majority.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would imagine that that's kind of like the U.S. You know, I just spent Christmas in Arizona. Everybody gets their wine from the grocery store. You know, here in New York, we're lucky enough to have amazing little boutique wine shops to shop well. But, you know, do you see the same push for those artisanal kind of products in France as in the same way we see in the U.S. right now?
It's here. Yeah, it's here. It's happening. It's definitely here. It's I think it's even more difficult in a time of economical crisis. You know, it's not the funniest time right now, honestly. It's happening locally, and when you have locally a group of people that can get together and have a strong voice, it's on. But otherwise, it's still pretty harsh. And as I say, there is no real support. You know, it's not like you don't have any television program telling you about how it's great to farm a certain way in terms of wine, the viticulture.
Yeah, and also I think here in New York, for example, Psalms, you're like superstars. You're what chefs used to be 5 or 10 years ago. You're no longer just someone working on the floor pouring wine. In France, for example, I'm going to talk about Paris because I'm from Paris. You've got all those restaurants with kick-ass natural 100% wine lists, and it's very full forward. But all these people, they just drink natural wine. They don't have the education behind. Whereas in New York, you get all the wines from all around the world. You can get them here in New York, and people have a tremendous amount of, I think, exposure to traditional, high-end, natural wines, industrial wines. It's much more broader knowledge in the United States than it is in France. So it's very interesting for both reasons. But
it's true that right now you can, we are going to France soon together, but like if we are anywhere, you can find good wines almost anywhere. But you need to plan. It's like eating great. Like, I'm planning a trip right now. I'm planning off a restaurant trip because I know we can't just drive and hope to find a good restaurant in a small town. It's not possible. It's going to be probably frozen food or crappy wine list or anything, you know. So you need to plan ahead in a country that you would have believed everywhere you will stop, it will be local product with traditional food with like... No, it's not like that. You need to plan. So it means something.
Yeah, exactly. For example, the Dives Bouteille where we're going in Anjou, it's, I think, the largest natural wine fair along with Raw and also Vinitaly.
Probably, yeah.
The off that they have out there. So you have to, like, the entire world is getting into Angers. So you do have to book a month, 2 months. I started booking 2 months in advance hotels and restaurants and places that we're going to be seeking out because there are a lot of them. But still, when you have like 3,000 people coming in, well, you know, there's 100 seats in those restaurants, so you just have to plan ahead.
So when you're talking Angers, you're talking about the Loire Valley, and this is a question that's actually been posed to me. Why is the Loire Valley seemingly kind of one of the main centers of natural wine in the world?
For me, the main reason. There is tourism. There is a diversity of soil and grapes. It's not like it's a monoculture of one thing, and so there is a variation of expression. And the second thing is money. Is the price of the land. Like, you can go in the Loire, you can go in Languedoc-Roussillon today, and you can buy a hectare of vine for a very decent price planted, and you can start to make your wine without having the feel that you just bought a million euro hectare with a company behind you, and you need to give back the money. So the day that you are going to start to work naturally, you have to really make that deal with nature. It's like, I'm going to follow what nature is going to be every year. It's not like you can't rely on a certain amount of crop that you're going to sell at a certain amount of price every year. Which means that you need to be very careful about the amount of investment you put back and how you can invest this wine. So you're going to be with more freedom if you can have 3 hectares of vine that you bought for 50,000 euros and you can make your wine somewhere and the investment in that small and you're the only one investing. Or if you buy a 2.5 million and you build a 1 million winery with 50 people, the pressure is not the same.
Are you ready to lose?
Yeah, you're ready to lose. I think this is a good question. And the Loire, Languedoc, patrimony of old vines that people didn't want to have to deal with anymore because they were just too low in for the kind of cheap industrial wines they were trying to make. You have young guys with a lot of ideas, with this incredible dynamic. And it's also regions that are very welcoming. I think the Loire is a very welcoming mm-hmm. region. It's not too tough to get into the Loire.
And they're pretty friendly. There's also this thing, when I was living, I moved back from the U.S. to France in 2011, and I lived there for 2.5 years. And in Paris, I would see a lot of Loire winemakers come up to Paris because of the proximity also. And also probably the history, 16th century, 15th century Rabelais. You're already talking about Pinot de Nice. The kings and queens would have their chateau, would go hunting, would drink the wines of the Loire. There is this proximity of Paris and the Loire, and the young people would always come and they meet with the buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this conversation going on. And if you have, that guy from Angers having lunch, and the next appointment that he has is a guy from Sancerre, they all sit together and they talk. Because, when they're in their, when winemakers are in their domains, they don't go and have lunch right and left. They're here to work. When they meet people is when they are in Paris selling, and it's when they're in natural salon, like La Dive, Les Affranchis, Le Vin de Mes Amis, La Remise. It's those are the opportunities they have to exchange. And I think that because the people in the Loire go to Paris often, gather together, It's an opportunity for them to exchange and maybe more and more have ideas.
And to have feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah, to have a real conversation. It's like Angers, Paris is 2 hours drive, 3 hours if you have traffic jam. It's pretty close, And I think you're right. Sancerre was made because of that. Sancerre was made because...
The proximity.
Because of the proximity, and they started to have a Sancerre wine bar, and so you put that, you put this exchange, you put this... human relationship, you put the thing that the land is cheap and you have great, you have great, great cépage. Like it's like great varieties.
Because we had to get over, because let's face it, back in the 70s, everywhere around France, everyone was using herbicides and pesticides. All the vineyards were hard as rock. No one was plowing anymore.
Bad clones.
Well, there were
highly productive clones, so
everything was industrialized, mechanized. So there was just basically between there, you had the grandparents. The parents went to industrialization. The grandparents who were farming naturally, and now you have the grandkids taking over all those vineyards and all the young people who want to come back, but they probably lost that generation. So their way to make it up is to chat with buyers, to chat with their peers. And I think that all of those natural wine salons offer that opportunity. And the trips to Paris and in the international traveling, the importers, I think, mm-hmm. all that energy all together really promotes it.
So Pascaline, speaking of natural wine, you're one of the biggest proponents of natural wine in New York City and maybe the world. I'm going to ask you, what is natural wine? Because that's a loaded question.
It's a loaded question. Oh... Man,
I'm sure you've answered it.
Yeah, but no, but like I'm taking it easy. I like what Alice Firing wrote in her book, which is a nothing added, nothing taken away, which I think is a good sum up. Yet everything is a little bit more complicated too. Everything is simple and complicated at the same time. So yeah, what is natural wine? Natural wine is, you have to understand the whole world of wine. I think if you want to understand natural wine, you have to understand that at one point, not a long time ago, as Camille was mentioning it, in the 70s, wine became a product. So the way you were producing your grapes and then you producing your wine made your wine a product where you could add a lot of things that were not here before. So is natural wine a myth? Yes and no. It's the idea that you can grow grape with respect of the soil while without using chemicals products, that you can grow according to the cycle of the vintage, and you are going to get grapes through that way of farming that can be organic or biodynamic, or even you have other ways like the Fukuoka method or things like that, the permaculture. You respect your plant. When you respect your plant by not doping it, you're going to get a grape that by itself is going to be able to ferment in a certain way that you're not going to have to use anything. You may play a little bit on the physical part, which is for me what I call physical manipulation, is you decide about the temperature, you know, just the idea of if you are able to have a cellar which is underground, or the way you are gonna do that. You decide about the press, you decide about the destemming. So it's just physical manipulation of the grape, but there is no chemical manipulation of your must or of your juice. And then you let the wine ferment naturally, because there is yeast and bacteria that, for me, are part of the environment, are different every year. You let that happen. There is a symbiosis happening with the juice, because they grow together, and you have a wine. The thing is you with the debate about natural wine is, it's always to understand the whole spectrum and the whole landscape of why this wine happens to be so loud these last years. It's because it's also a reaction of something that we were not told about in the winemaking process. And people came up and said, and they were very, very, very expressive about it. And yes, I have something for natural wine. It's because just I've been lucky to first to visit a lot of vineyards. And when you're lucky to go in a vineyard and you travel and you see a naturally farmed vineyard with people really taking care of the plant, it just makes right away sense. You know, as Camille says, it's not the soil is not cement. The plant is growing healthy. There is a natural balance. And I've been always very sensitive to that growing of plants. And then when you taste the wine, none of them are perfect. And I'm not even sure there is a definition of perfection. But there is a level of expression that is unique. Like, let's admit it, it's just unique. The less you put in your wine and you just let things happen, yes, you may have a bit of VA, you may have some bit of bread, it's not going to be the perfect round ball of fruit and spice and all that stuff that you are looking for, but the wine is going to taste like nothing else. And this is the magic of wine. You know, like, how many products can you eat or drink that can be so unique from a place and a person and a time that you can keep? Like, when you think about it, how many, so distinctive, how many products? There is one. It's wine. It's so fucking fantastic. So let's preserve that. It's magical. It's just magical. And you need to wait. You need, well, natural wine, for me, are the most challenging as a sommelier. Being a sommelier today is very easy. It's very easy. Okay, like in 1862 or 1826 or 18, sommelier had to buy wine in barrels and bottle their wine out of barrels down the cellar. It was like that in Paris also in the 1950s or 60s. Okay, today a sommelier goes on 750, look at certain things, look at online and other wine lists. It's a caricature, but like, you have an incredible amount of information here. It's extraordinary. You can taste all the wine in the world, and you're vintage, vertical, everywhere. You have a crowd, you have guests that are so ready for that, so excited about it. You don't even have to convince them anymore. They are just ready to discover, to like, to love. They are here. They have the money, especially in New York. It's just extraordinary. Being a sommelier today is just fantastic, and it's very simple because the wine is pretty easy to find. You have distributors, importers that do all the work for you. You know, it's fantastic. You have a restaurant scene that is just bursting with energy and dynamic. So you have your clientele here. You have peers that you can chat with and everything. Yet, I think the job hasn't been that difficult if you really start to work with natural wine. Just because most of the wine you are going to be able to open, they are going to be good right away. And you don't even taste them anymore. And for me, it's just like you just open bottles. But if you are really somebody that start to build a list and work with this wine, suddenly you are challenged back again, probably the way so many were challenged back years before when they were bottling their own wine. And working with natural wine, you need to follow this wine. You need to test them. You need to know if it's slightly reduced. You need to know, oh, maybe there is a pretty little problem of oxidation right now. Maybe it's a wine I need to wait 6 months. Maybe it's a wine I need to decant. Maybe it's a wine that suddenly, instead of the wine, everything being given to you, you are back to this wait and see, and the wine is the center of the focus. And I love that for natural wine, but it makes them challenging.
They're pretty moody wines also.
Yeah, but it's...
Because it makes
the beauty of it.
Yeah, but when I go, for example, I'm not going to look at my lunar calendar when I go out every day of the week, you know? And the other day I got caught by a fucking lunar eclipse, and I was like, fuck me. Basically, you have to go out every day and explain to the people, wine, natural wine, is just like us. You don't wake up every day in the same mood and happy. Some days it's really great, and sometimes it just doesn't taste perfectly great. Well, there's a lunar knot. And so your buyer's going to say, oh, so I should really look at my lunar calendar and not open wine on that or that day. I'm like, no, you should. But it helps you to understand that it's not always the same. And it's alive. And I think that's the beauty of what we're working with.
It's a living product. Mm-hmm. It's a living product.
Yeah.
But it's also where you need to say, okay, my God, this wine was a bit reduced last week, or there is a... I'm just going to tell you, but right now I have a problem with the mousy taste in a lot of wine, white wine, so it's a very specific bacterial taste that you have. And used to have it in a lot of red, and I have it in white. And it's been a question for me since 4 years now, and I talk with a lot of winemakers. And one of the way to get that mousy taste away from white, in my experience and my dialogue with these guys, is to wait. So you have to wait for the wine. Like, wait 6 months or a year and a half.
Yeah, at least nine. For example, there's this winemaker I love, Alain Castex, in the Roussillon. Each time I taste his wines at La Remise in April, when he just bottles it, mouse. It's not actually one mouse. It's a herd of fucking mouse. But I know that in 9 months afterwards, it'll be gone. It's just premature oxidation and bottling, and it's going to go away. You shouldn't freak out. You should wait. It gauges your patience, those wines.
It gauges your ability to taste also. You know, it's like, and you know that this wine, you can't decant them and all that stuff. So suddenly, your job and my job become again dynamic with the product. And I think it's fascinating. Like, seriously, I think this is great. But you really need to go learn how to taste and learn how to taste on a regular basis with winemaker. It's a key. Otherwise, you just open bottles that taste the same all the time. It's like, come on.
You think it's important to taste wine at least 3 times a year? After the press, you know, in October, just before the assemblage, around February or April, and once the wine is bottled, also it's important to those within a year on those 3 stages to taste the wine, because they'll be completely different. And I think after 5 years of tasting 3 times a year the wine of a winemaker, you could start to have an idea of where you're going.
So I obviously understand this through the sommelier perspective, but then how do we educate the guest on this? How do we explain to them that this wine is changing? Because don't people want to come in and have consistency?
You all want to have a great date. You all hope it's going to happen well.
But this is also where you need to know what you are selling. You know, I'm sorry, you are putting a whole natural wine list. Let's say you build a whole natural wine list. Okay. You need to know your wine. I'm sorry. You need to know your wine. You need to know your producer. You need to taste. You need to taste your wine pretty frequently. You need to ask questions to your... You need to build a relationship with your wine. You need to build a relationship with your distributor of trust and honesty, and say, you know, I have no problem asking questions. You know, I'm like, hey, you know what? I tried the wine like that the other day. Is it like, how do you feel? Is it something that you had already before? You know, you need to follow up. You just can't throw a natural wine list on nature and just expect everything.
Yeah, I think as an importer distributor, I learn as much from my from my growers than I do from my somms. It's the feedback from both sides that's super interesting. And I think by building up the conversation and keeping it open and flowing, that we'll get to learn. Because let's put it pretty frankly, the more I taste wine, the more I understand, I know less and less and less. And it's pretty exciting, even though...
It's why we do the job. But you to educate, you. I'm sorry, you need to know your wine. You know, it's not something we do with EMS, but like I, at the restaurant, all the team was tasting the wine all the time. We test every bottle. So why? One reason is we don't think that is a guest responsibility to tell us that the wine is corked. It's our job. I'm sorry if the wine is corked, I'm not going to have you try a corked wine and blah, blah, blah. But also it's to follow up where the wine is at right now. You know, it's a key. It's very, very important. So you need to know that, and then you need to know, okay, is it a very, very challenging wine because there is a lot of oxidation or a lot of phenolics or a lot of skin contact or there is a huge amount of VA, but there is probably not enough alcohol or sweetness to balance it out, and oh, there is a little of bread. Do you know what I'm talking about? Can I translate in the language of anybody what I mean by slightly bready and VA wine? Can I translate that, or can I be good enough to understand in 30 seconds what my guest want? And if he wants to try, maybe I'm not going to try right away with something that has a lot of asperity or a lot of intensity on certain level. I'm going to try something a bit milder. Is why you need to know your winist. You need to know your wine. You need to go to tasting. You need to try the wine as much as you can. And there is, honestly, the world of buying, and you know that, you buy wine. The guys are ready, the rep, your distributor are ready to come to do staff testing with you. Like, come on, use that. It's great. It's not only you, it's your staff.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, you have to know your wine, and that's how you will be able to translate it to the guest. I look at the sommelier as being a translator in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's not easy. How many wines do you have on your list?
Over 600.
Yeah, it's okay. It's difficult to keep track of your 600 wine. Mm-hmm. And maybe there is one you haven't tried because you have only one single bottle that you were like transferred and is like 1960s, I don't know, things. Mm-hmm. But potentially you have an idea of what it can taste, and you also lost when you're going to open that bottle and taste it, you have enough knowledge of wine tasting to assess what's happening in the bottle and to be able to go to the guest and say, guys, I'm sorry, I think the wine passes prime. I can have you try, but I think this is off. And or yes and no, you know, and it's taking notes all the time, and it's following. It's needs to be serious with your job, you know.
So you were recently featured in an article in Bon Appetit as one of the sommeliers to watch in 2015. Why do you? I mean, I feel like as someone in the wine business in New York, I've known of you for a long time. So welcome to the world, Bon Appetit. You know, but congratulations. It's a great feature.
Thanks. No, I'm very it. And it's a great... No, sorry. It's just because you read all my bio and you probably just spend a lot of time on Google this morning.
No. I read that article.
Wait. Isn't there another natural... sommelier on it?
Lee's part of it. Yeah. And Dana Frank also in Portland, Oregon. I don't know the three others, but I know Dana and I know Lee, and they are fucking kick-ass women. And I have such a tremendous respect for Lee. And Dana, she's really doing some great things in Portland. Her husband is a winemaker for Bow and Harrow, which is one of my favorite Oregon wine.
They were there last year at the Dive. Yeah. I remember it was the end of the tasting. It was like 6 or 7 o'clock, and I bumped into them and we started doing an apéro, and they came in. They were super humble, and
they love Loire Valley. He makes Melon Bourgogne, he makes Gamay. He's and the wine are really
outstanding.
Good.
Yeah, really delicious.
So it's all really great guys, and so it was a bliss. Like, I was proud, and I love Lee, you know. Like, Lee, she's really
Lee.
So I was totally struck by one of the questions, or your responses to one of the questions. They posed the question, the biggest problem facing, they said the industry, but I'm assuming they said the sommelier industry. Your response was, women versus men sommeliers, you're over it. The problem for me is that the industry is mostly white. I want you to elaborate on that. I mean, do you really think the men versus women thing is over?
Like, you know, the way the question was asked, since I'm in a sommelier business, so since now, starting in 05, so like 9 years, I've been asked this question over and over again. And it's,
I'm sure.
And I don't say it's, I didn't say that straightly.
Exactly. Okay.
I said, you know, this is a question I've been asked over and over again. I just think right now there is definitely a dynamic going in the right direction. Like, it's, look how many women are here. You know, it's not anymore, there is no discrimination, like, maybe, but there is not this men versus woman, and it's a men job, and blah, 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 blah. I never felt it.
In the U.S., never felt it. Go to France, and yeah. then you'll get a
it's
a
France is more difficult, I agree, but we are talking about the U.S., and I'm like, you know, here, I'm sorry, it's never been a problem for me, and see how many women are taking position, and I really think, and I just, something, I just worked in New York. I never worked anywhere else, so for me, New York, woman versus man, is not that of a, as a, it doesn't strike me as a man difficulties you have when you enter this profession. I just thought, because I had a lot of discussion with my girlfriend and all the friends recently, and I'm like, and we are talking with a journalist, with Belle, and like, you know, probably the other question is like, I see a lot of students, because I start to teach now at ICC and with a master and everything, there is a diversity of nationalities at that level that you don't find at the upper level. That's it. And you are like, okay, why? And it's very striking for me, especially in New York, because it's such an incredible diversity. And maybe the next question or the next idea is like, it's just maybe why? Is it probably a question that also worth to be asked?
I totally agree, and I don't think we have the answer yet.
No, I don't think so, but I think it works to invite, like, just to... The man-woman is a little bit just a too easy wine and a too cliché wine today, and when you have been asked the question, is more about today maybe a bit sensational, and I have to admit, I never had any issue. So...
I never have either, so... I mean, I agree with you on that. I just want to know, you know, your side of it.
I just was thinking, like, about who I hired as my assistant and who is, like, where recently I hired to work with me and who is coming to me, you know, as a potential sommelier and working with me. It's not the same thing as the potential bartenders you're going to have. It's not the same population. So that's it. And I just wonder why.
It's a good question to ask. So getting back to what you do on a day-to-day basis, Rouge Tomat closed this last year in its Uptown space.
Mm-mm.
And now you guys are moving this June, reopening, correct? Flatiron?
No, it's going to be later than that.
Later than June, but summer-ish.
Second half of 15. Yeah, I can't really say. Time of construction, but second half of 15, not before that.
With closing the Uptown Rouge Tomat, are there changes that you're going to be making in the new space, or are you kind of just flowing it back into the same thing that you were doing before?
No, there will be a transition. So there will be things that are going to remain, and there will be things that we are going to have to adapt for the neighborhood. The remaining will be what is the core of us, which is the focus on the farm to table, the focus of the quality of the sourcing, the focus on the nutrition, the focus on being a green restaurant. This is remaining 1,000,000,000%. It's going to even be stronger. So this is really, really here. Then we are going to adapt just because it's not going to be exactly the same clientele. We are going to keep some items from the previous one. When we want people to come and realize that there are Rouge Tomat when they walk, yet feeling that there is something very different. So, yes, there will be changes. I just can't really talk about. But there will be things. And I'm personally, you know, what we achieved something very special over there. I don't think people, they got it for the wineries because probably I was just more out and more vocal, but we achieved something in this neighborhood with the way we're cooking, and you know, it was no bullshit marketing thing. When the way that we're sourcing, the amount of time spent, the real work with the nutritionist for how to eat a better food by the way we were putting the product together and cooking them. And seriously, at a very good price. I'm like, I knew where the product were from, and like the price was super reasonable. And yes, it was in the Upper East Side, and it was this beautiful fancy restaurant. But the heart of the food was very, very, very true to the idea. And I don't think people realized it as much, and I hope they will realize it more. I'm very proud of what Chef is doing every day. Like. And I'm staying because I'm so proud of what we are doing. You know, between that, the partnership we had with farms, the education we did with kids and schools, you know, we are very involved in. It's not only a restaurant. It's a whole idea of you can eat better by choosing where you get the product and how you prepare them, and by spreading the word and by teaching people how to do so. And we want to keep on doing the same thing. And it's going to be even worse with wine, you know, it's... So
you mean even better? I was going to say, what could complement that style of a restaurant better than natural wine?
One with a like, it's pretty cheesy, but one with a soul, you know, like one where you put a wine, you know that there is a person behind, and this person behind made this wine in a certain way because he's respectful and he believes, you know, that's it. It's at the end, it's super simple.
And Baskadine, I'm super stunned as of today when I hit the streets and visit 8 restaurants a day. You have so many farm to table restaurants that still put shit in their glasses. It's incredible to think about that. They talk about farmers and then they're just going to put industrial
sulfury wine.
Oh, sulfur is not even the worst, you know,
yeah,
but it's going to be
really not the worst you can drink.
No. I'd rather have a wine, you know, with a little bit of sulfur that hasn't been fined and filtered. To me, fine and filter is really when I lose it.
But there is worse than that, you know.
No, there is worse than that.
Huh?
Yeah.
I'm sure you don't want to know.
No.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for Kemi putting your input in, and Pascaline, thank you so much for just completely giving your heart out about wine for us.
Well, thanks for having us. Thanks, Kemi. Yeah. Can you just not break the studio yet?
Yeah, it's all right. It's all right, Kemi.
I think it's this bottle of Strohmeyer. It's getting to me.
Yeah, we are enjoying great bottle of sparkling Strohmeyer from Austria. So thanks, Roberta, for the wine.
Thanks, Monica. Thanks, Jenny and Francois, for this bottle.
Thanks, Amanda, for putting
Amanda,
it on the list.
Thanks, Amanda. For putting it on the list.
So, you know, only girls, huh?
Yeah,
you see?
Also, too.
We're going to take a break here on The Morning After. We're going to come back with The Morning After quiz.
Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After in studio today. Pascaline LePeltier, master sommelier and beverage director at Rouge Tomat. It's everyone's favorite time of the hour. It is The Morning After quiz. Pascaline, you know a lot about the restaurant Rouge Tomat, where you're the beverage director, but what do you know about the 1991 seminal film of female bonding, Fried Green Tomatoes?
I know the French title.
How do you say it in French?
Beignet de tomate verte.
That's not what they call it here.
No,
so
I
good
know,
luck.
I know.
Here comes the morning after quiz, Pascaline. All right, question one. Actually, you know what? I kind of feel like maybe I should give you a little bit of an idea, and to the listeners out there, if they haven't seen this amazing film, kind of just the premise of it, because it's quite convoluted. This film follows a middle-aged Southern woman's self-discovery through the rich and sometimes scandalous autobiographical storytelling of an elderly woman. So you've got the premise of the movie now.
I totally get it. Yeah. I can see it.
Totally
get it. I can direct it.
All right. Question one. Two of the main characters, Ruth and Iggy, open a cafe in their small Alabama town. What is the cafe's name? Just the name of a cafe. I'm going to give you 3 multiple choice questions. A, Alabama Mama Cafe. B, Whistle Stop Cafe. C, Fried Green Tomato Cafe.
Whistle Stop.
B, Whistle Stop Cafe. Bravo. Parfait. Look Ooh. At you. Okay, question two. No one's ever gotten them all right, Pascaline. No pressure. All right. Question two. The film, based on a book of the same name, faced some controversy when it decided to omit the lesbian relationship between Ruth and Iggy. The director of the film argued that which of these scenes between the two characters was as symbolic as lovemaking? All right. A, when they dance the Charleston together. When they B, have a food fight. Or when they C, go to the rodeo together. Which of these scenes is as symbolic as lovemaking?
Thank you. I think personally myself, I would say rodeo, but I'm going to take the Charleston.
The Charleston. No, it is actually the food fight. What's more sexual than a food fight, Pascaline?
Freaking rodeo.
Everything. Yeah, I know.
My girlfriend hates when we play with food. So like, mommy's like, no go.
None of this is based on reality, Pascaline. Remember this. Okay. All right. All right. Well, you got one question
correct. Is it making kind of fried beignet?
Fried beignet throwing at each other?
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know. Did you see the movie?
Did
you see the movie?
I saw the movie. And? I can't remember this. I saw this movie when I was like maybe like 15 years old.
Wow. And so?
Well, I didn't think it was symbolic of lovemaking because they
Because
omitted.
You thought it was rodeo.
All right. You know what? We're all going to sit down. We're going to have a bag of popcorn. We're going to watch Fried Green Tomatoes and we're going to really break it down. Okay.
It's going to be awesome.
We've got one more question. All right. Question three. In an attempt to spice things up with her husband, Kathy Bates's character, Evelyn Couch, decides to dress herself up entirely in ... Is it A, fried green tomatoes?
It would be pretty awesome.
Is it B, cellophane? Or is it C, honey? This is as hard as your Master Sommelier exam, I'm sure.
It's very sexual.
I didn't mean to make it this way, but it is. It's a chick flick. Come on.
Honey.
Honey. No, actually, Pascaline, it was cellophane.
You're kidding.
What's sexier than cellophane?
Honey.
The rodeo and honey. Pascaline, thank you so much for being such a good sport.
No, thank you so much for open up my landscape of fried tomatoes things.
You would think that there'd be a lot more fried tomatoes involved in the storyline, but there really isn't.
My God, I really need to watch this movie.
You need to watch it.
Yeah.
You
do. But it was pretty awesome to chat with you.
You too. Yeah. Pascaline, what is how do we follow you? I know you're pretty active in the social media world. Is it at Pascaline Lepelletier?
It's at P Lepelletier.
Okay.
I didn't really know how to put my handle before that. So it's at P Lepelletier.
I think that's pretty good though.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to mess that up.
I mess it up pretty often.
We'll follow Pascaline. She's obviously going on a food tour of France upcoming. So I'm sure that'll be excited to check her out. And then we'll all be waiting with bated breath for when Rouge Tomate opens in the Flatiron.
Thanks. It's going to be great. You know that.
I absolutely
know. Fried chicken, green fried chicken. I'm just going to chef just for that, just for you. We are going to call it the Jesse's Rodeo Cellophane Honey or something like that. You know?
I would love to have that kind of dish named after me. Thank you so much, Pascaline. Sari, we'll see you next week on The Morning After. Love you all. Bye-bye. Morning After on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.